Save big money now on new siding from LP Smart Side at Menards. Update and beautify your home with your choice of 13 timeless colors of pre-finished engineered siding. It's durable and includes a Sherwin-Williams factory finish paint warranty that means no painting for years to come. View our entire selection of siding from LP Smart Side today. And don't forget to check out our flyer on Menards.com for all the great deals happening now.
Save big money at Menards.
Maybe. Benny isn't the dream. We are. Maybe we're nothing more than figments of his imagination. For all we know, at this very moment, somewhere far beyond all those distant stars, Benny Russell is dreaming of us.
Welcome, everyone, to another episode of the Positively Trek Book Club. I'm Dan Gunther, and with me, believe it or not, is Bruce Gibson. Bruce is back for this very special episode of Positively Trek. Bruce, how's it going?
It's going really well. I decided, you know what? This is a special occasion. It's time to come out of the wormhole and make my appearance on the show.
Excellent. Well, you probably just heard another voice there, which is the reason why this is a very special episode. We have on the show none other than Derek Tyler Attico, editor... in quote marks, of the autobiography of Benjamin Sisko, which we will be talking about on the show. So, Derek, welcome to the show. I'm so excited to have you here.
Dan, Bruce, thank you so much for having me, man. I've been waiting for this for a while. Dan, you know, we've known each other for a minute. Thanks for having me. I'm excited. I'm excited. Let's do it.
Oh, man. Yeah, me too. I have to say at the start, I've been wanting to have you on the show for a long time, and I'm giddy to be able to talk to you, especially about this book, because I really feel like it's taking fandom by storm. It's incredible. It's really good. And this is a high bar, but I think it's my favorite of the Titan autobiographies they've done of the Star Trek folks.
Thank you. I don't even know how to deal with that. So I'll just say thank you. that's very kind. The other books are phenomenal. I've read them, and you know, I was like, oh my god, I gotta meet that bar. But thank you very much. Thank you.
Well, yeah, we'll jump in. And to our listeners, I want to say the first part of this will be spoiler free. So if you have not gotten the book, go ahead, feel free to listen. We'll give you a warning when we get into spoilers. But I will have to say, you know, if you haven't picked up this book, you really, really ought to, especially if you're even the slightest Deep Space Nine fan. This book is just such a great companion to that wonderful show. And I think you're really doing yourself a disservice if you don't read this one. So go do that. But we'll give you a warning when we get into spoilers.
Yeah, I just want to add to that real quick, because I've been doing a rewatch of DS9. I kind of slowed down for a while, but I'm in the seventh season. And now, especially reading this book while I'm watching, do my rewatch, it changes some of my perspective when I look at Captain Sisko. So we'll go deeper into that kind of stuff.
Nice.
But it really enhances it.
Nice. I'll say really quick that I'm fighting a little bit of a cold. So I'll be popping cough drops and I'll be drinking and sipping tea as we go. So just to let you and the fans know, if you hear me sniffling, that's what that is, you know. You should know, Bruce, you know, being in and out of the wormhole, it has those problems, you know, with atmosphere and all that. It deals with that. So yeah, that's what I'm dealing with.
I thought you were just getting a little choked up by what
we were saying. Well, that too. I mean, of course, right? Yeah, of course, that too. No, I'm just really happy that people are liking it, because when I wrote it, you know, you have an NDA and I did the outline and everything, but you're writing in a vacuum. You know, I can't speak to anybody about it. I can't. I have a cadre of people that I usually tap, you know, for like short stories and stuff. But you know, I couldn't do any of that, so I had to just be like, trust my gut. This is what I came up with, and go. And you know, you're writing in a vacuum, and you get in the middle of it, and you're like, is any of this good? It's like, yes, it's good. It's just, you know, people are going to like it. But you just have to make those decisions and just stay the course, you know, stay the course. Mm-hmm. And that's what I did for this, and I'm just really happy that people are enjoying the origin story I brought to Benjamin Sisko.
Excellent. Well, let's dive into a little bit of your background first. I want to know, I'm always curious how people came to Star Trek, how you became a fan. You know, what was your first awareness of Star Trek and the part it played in
Oh
your
my God,
life?
man. My father was really my mom and dad, but my dad used to in the olden days used to repair televisions. Back when, televisions were expensive and people actually had like a TV repairman come to the house and stuff, which is like eons ago. And he would repair them, and I have this distinct memory of him working on a television in our living room, which he would do all the time. And it was on. I don't know why he would work on the wire on, but that's another thing. But it was on, and he was behind it, on the inside, working on the insides. On the screen was this guy with pointy ears in a blue shirt with his hands on this creature, and he was in pain, and he was feeling this creature's pain. And it was the episode Devil in the Dark, and he was talking to the Hoarder. And I couldn't have been more than 6, 7 years old. And I was all in. I was hooked. And my parents were like, oh yeah, that's Star Trek, And from that moment, I just started watching Star Trek. And the ideals of Star Trek were very interesting to me. I talked about this in an essay, actually. The ideals of Star Trek were very interesting because those were the same ideals that my parents were teaching me. And it was interesting for me as a kid to see like there were these adults on television that were upholding the things that my parents, because usually parents would tell you stuff, but you're like, you don't see those things. But here's where a group of people in the future helping people for no reason other than to help people. Everybody was equal. Everybody was the same. Everybody was working together. And I really just gravitated towards that and just really was really all in. And then my mom and I would watch it all the time, all the time. And I was hooked after that. So I started with TOS. And then I kind of got into TOT on TNG, but I really didn't like TNG, if I'm being really honest, that much. Didn't like it that much. And then a friend of mine's like in 2004, he said, hey, they got this thing called the Star Trek Strange New Worlds anthology contest. And fans are able to like just write a story, send it in. And if it's any good, they'll publish like the best, like 10 or 12. And I was like, oh, that's cool. I like Star Trek. Okay. So I started watching TNG. And by that time it was around, I think, well, I guess, I don't know. I guess TNG was done by that time, right? But so I started watching it, and I was like, oh man, TNG is really, really good. It's exactly what Roddenberry started in TOS. It's the same values, the same ideals. The characters all harken back to the original series. And I fell in love with that. So I wrote a story, Alpha and Omega, submitted that for Star Trek Strange New Worlds. That got in and took first place. So I was really honored with that. And that started me.
Wait. So you've never written before, like anything? Like, had you been writing fiction? Was this like your first time you ever wrote fiction?
Pretty much, yeah. I mean, the only thing I had written before then,
It's amazing.
when I was 16, well, I saw Star Wars as a kid. At 10 years old, I saw the original Star Wars. So then I wanted to know like everything there was to know about like how George Lucas did it. And I was like, well, I wanted to learn how to direct and how to screenwrite. So I just like read a lot about writing and directing and all that. So from like 10 to 16, I did nothing but read all this stuff. And so I started writing a Star Wars screenplay at 16. In high school, I gave it to my English teacher to check my grammar and everything. And she took like 2 months to give it back to me. And I'm like, who takes 2 months to get out? I was like, what's going on? She's like, you can give it back to me. I'll give it back to you, but you have to come with me to Manhattan. And I got your mom's consent. And I'm like, what is going on? Turns out she submitted it to the Dramatists Guild of America award contest, where they pick 12 out of 12,000 students across America. They pick 12 screenplays. And mine was one of the 12. That was the first thing I'd ever written, ever.
Oh my gosh, do you know you have this underlying talent you didn't know about until later?
Yeah. So that first thing I ever wrote was a screenplay. It was a Star Wars screenplay
Wow.
that got in. So then I wanted to. I was like, wow. So then for college, I wanted to go to NYU, Tisch School of the Arts. I applied. I got accepted. I couldn't afford it, so I never went. That's the the way things happen. So I was like, I decided to go on Johnson College Criminal Justice for law as a fallback. After 2 years of that, I was like, oh my God, I'm not ethically the person to be a lawyer. You know, it's just, you just have to have a whole different set of, anyway, I can't be a lawyer. Yeah, I can't be a lawyer. I'm like, not trashing a lawyer.
Yeah, you have those Star Trek values, right?
Yes, I don't want to trash on lawyers, but yes, Bruce. So I realized pretty quick, and even like my professors at John Jay were like, Derek, you're just not built. You're built for arts and writing. That's what you're just built for, you know? But, you know, I needed to make money. I needed to have a career. So I went into video production, video editing, and I just never did anything with my craft. And then Strange New Worlds came around. And so that was the first time I had written, gosh, that had to be the first time I had written anything in easily 10 years, you know? And I had no formal training. The only formal training I had was I took a class from Denny O'Neill on writing for comics. That was pretty much it. And so, I wrote that story, submitted it, and it got in and took first place. So I was very thankful and very, you know, honored to get in.
I just have to say, though, like, for people, if you haven't read this story, Strange New Worlds number 8, and Strange New Worlds, confusingly, is the short story right. contest, not the current show. But yeah, it's the grand prize winner in number 8, and it is such a good story. Like, I remember when I first read it, that's when I went online and said, who is this guy? I hadn't heard the name before, looked you up, and I was just like, this is incredible. This is such a good story. I don't want to give things away on this because people need to experience it, but it has to do with Q and the Borg and a whole bunch of other stuff with Star Trek, and it goes in directions you wouldn't expect. And the one thing that kind of echoed through my mind while I was reading it was in the Voyager episode Q2, when Q yells at his son, if the Continuum's told you once, they've told you 1,000 times, don't provoke the Borg. And we find out why in this story.
Right, right, right. We find out why. And there's that moment in All Good Things when Q is, Picard, at the very end, Picard asks Q, he says, Q, what are you trying to tell me? And Q goes next to his ear and is about to say something and then pulls back. And that was the impetus for Alpha and Omega. I was like, what was he going to say, you know? And I was like, oh, that is what he was going to say. So Alpha and Omega, you could read it and then it ties into everything, you know? And a lot of the themes today in Picard, you could see, I'm like, oh, wow, Alpha and Omega. So it shows that I was had my pulse, had my finger on the pulse of things. So yeah, after that, I realized I could write. So I tried to start a professional career writing. I didn't know a lot about the business of writing, though. I still need to learn a lot about that. And I was writing stories here and there and just like, you know, working, living life. And then 2016 came around, and that was the 50th anniversary of Star Trek. And I hadn't had a lot of professional sales under my belt. So they, Simon and Schuster Pocket Books, announced they were releasing, they were bringing back the Star Trek Strange New Worlds Anthology Contest just for the 50th anniversary. And I was like, hey, this is my opportunity to write another Star Trek story. Who knows when I'm going to have the opportunity to do that. So this time I wrote a Benny Russell Deep Space Nine story. And I was like, I'm going to write the story that I want to write. And I wrote it and I was like, this is never going to get in because this is just, it's meta. It's, you know, it's just, it's never going to get in. And it got in, you know, which was nuts. It got in. It's still nuts. I think about it. It's still nuts. It got in.
Derek, do you play the lottery? Because you really should.
For real.
Because you win. You're winning all the time. You know that.
For real. No, I'm thankful, man, because you're right. But I'm thankful. I mean, it's, you know, it's not a thing of like ego or anything. A friend of mine said, man, Derek, if you realize what you had, what you have, you wouldn't have it. And I think that's a, you know, if a person starts to think about, oh, I have this or have that, you start to diminish what you have. Does that make any sense? You know what I'm saying? So yeah, I'm just thankful. I obviously I have an ability and I'm thankful that I'm using it and that people are enjoying it, because that's a big deal. Is that you have this ability and then you're saying things and that people are, it's resonating with people. That's what's really huge. I remember with Alpha and Omega, some guy emailed me and he said, you know, I read Alpha and Omega and I'm reading it to my 8-year-old kid, but I'm not reading it. I'm reading it a little bit every night to him before bed. What else do I need? What other review do I need to, you know what I'm saying? I mean, that's it. That was all I, and that's honestly, that's the only review I really remember about Alpha and Omega, because that somebody's reading something I wrote to their kid at night. So I was like, wow. So that was a big deal for me. And then I did the, you know, the, and, the Benny Russell story, that was well received. And then we jump ahead to now. Basically what happened was, and here's the thing, which is what I wanted to talk about, because there was a, as the story as I remember, there was a podcast, someone was talking about, oh, they're doing the autobiographies and that Titan does the beautiful autobiographies. They skipped Cisco. And some podcasts were saying, oh, they should do, they did Janeway, they should do Cisco. And then someone on Twitter said, well, if they do a Cisco autobiography, they should do, or this guy Attico should do it. And it dawned on me, like when we were talking about the this interview, was that you that said that?
That was me. That's crazy.
Nuts.
I was gonna bring up this tweet to ask where it sits in the timeline.
Dude,
you're blowing my mind.
No, you're
right
blowing
now.
Your mind, dude. All right. So first of all, thank you. Seriously.
Oh man.
So, yes, thank you, Dan.
No, Dan. So
it's because of Dan that it led to this.
No, I mean, let's be serious. So here's what happened. So. One day I come on to, and I don't know what day, but one day I come on to Twitter. You know, you come on Twitter, and my name is blown up on Twitter. I'm like, what? You know, because usually I'll get like 5 hits, 3 hits, a hit, if I'm lucky, you know? And my name is blowing up. I'm like, what's going on? What did I do? I didn't do anything. And people are like, oh, yeah, I've heard of Attico and this and that. And I'm like, what? And I was like, oh, that's cool. Somebody said that I should do the autobiography. And I was like, yeah, that would be dope, but that's gonna ever happen. That's gonna ever happen. But then a voice was in my head was like, well, you know, they did skip Cisco. How would you do it? I'm like, oh yeah, there's ways I could do it. You know, and I started thinking about ways I would do it. And you know, and you don't think about anything. And then I don't know, a year or two goes by, and managing editor of Titan Books reaches out to me on Twitter, George Sanderson. And he says, hey, I'd like to speak to you about a project. We set up a conversation. We start talking. And he says, we read The Dream and the Dream, your Benny Russell story. And they also had heard about that. But I think from what I understand, they heard about it through that whole Twitter thing. And then they went back and read the Benny Russell story. So I think it was a Twitter thing that got them to look at the Deep Space Nine, you know, Strange New World story. And they were like, oh, he would be a good fit for this. So Dan, man. Thank you, man.
I'm wondering if someone else tweeted about it too, because I'm looking at the old tweet and it has like 9 likes and stuff. So I'm wondering if there was also somebody else.
I remember I tweeted it. I retweeted it, of course. And then it had a little bit of a life, like a day. It had like a little bit of a good, right? I was like, what? And then I retweeted it, and then somebody else retweeted it, and it got up there. I mean, it wasn't like I'm gonna say it's like thousands. No. But it was like 100 or less, you know. Which from Derek, that's 1,000, you know. That's a lot, you know. and it's enough to like, it was like, oh wow, this is interesting. And I guess somebody took a look at it, right? So it was enough for somebody to take a look at it, and they went and took a look at that Strange New World story and read that, the Benny Russell story, Dream in a Dream. And from there, we had the conversation. And by that time, I had figured out how I wanted to do it, how I wanted to frame autobiography of Benjamin Cisco. They liked the idea I had, the framing device that I had, because Titan had a great idea where it would be done through Jake, of course, Jake Cisco, who's an author in the story in canon on the show. And in the future, we know he's written this book called Anselm, which is biographical, and it would have elements of his father in that. And I thought that's a great idea, and that book should be done. But my argument was the other autobiographies have been the captains in their own words. And even if we do Jake, that's not going to, it's going to be really Jake's biography, and it's going to be like, you know, Jake and his father's autobiography. What we really need is to hear from Benjamin Sisko in his own words. And here's my framing device where we can do that. And if you still want to have mm-hmm. Jake, we can still do that with my framing device. And so when I explained that, it was like, oh, that's a great idea. So that got me the gig.
Yeah, because when I was going into this book, I was wondering how that was going to be handled. And I thought, I bet Ben Sisko was writing his autobiography and it ends right before he goes into the wormhole. Like, that's where I thought it was going to go. But it was really interesting how you framed that, because it makes sense for Jake, who's an author, to write on behalf of Sisko, but it's being communicated from Ben Sisko to Jake.
Right, right. And I was brought up really heavily in religion and Christianity. And my mom had me reading a lot of the classics as a kid. I had like college level reading in fourth grade. So I was steeped in like literature and classics. So, you know, we are very, and we as a society, as a people, as a species are very familiar in our mythology with deities or mythological gods speaking to humans or speaking to us from their places of wherever they are. That's nothing new.
Right.
So that was like, okay, well, that's something that, because the biggest challenge with something like this is to do something that can is palpable to the audience, that they can wrap their heads around really quickly and be like, oh, that makes sense. You know?
Well, and at the same time, the prophets speak to Ben.
Right. All the time. You know, and this is a lot of this is built on the shoulders of, you know, the writers of Deep Space Nine to begin with, right? I'm working on a lot of the foundational groundwork that they've established. And I was like, well, it just makes sense. Also, the last shot in What You Leave Behind, the last episode of Deep Space Nine, we see Jake and he's looking out and he never gets to speak to his father. Ben speaks to Cassidy, but he never speaks to Jake. So it just made sense for me that in the book, Ben, as soon as he gets into the wormhole, speaks to Jake. But because it's all new to him, being here in a more foundational way, and him having this ability now, even though it's the first thing he does, Jake doesn't get the message right away, actually. He gets it a few years later.
It made so much sense to me because there's Ben in the wormhole, and like you said, he really didn't get to talk to Jake before he left.
Right.
And knowing what happens in an alternate reality or an alternate timeline, I should say, from the Visitor episode.
The Visitor, yeah.
This is his chance because he doesn't know if he'll ever speak to Jake again. You know, this is the chance to say what he's always wanted to say and explain everything he's been through and how he was raised and their culture and how much influence that had on him. This is the chance to do that and relay that to his son.
Absolutely. Absolutely. And the events of the Visitor was another framing device also, because for Ben's character and characterization, you know, Ben experienced those events and he doesn't want to see a repeat of that, because, you know, if you think about it from Ben's perspective, he watched his son's life and in many ways become a shell of a man, you know, all for trying to bring back his father, you know, and he gave up. Here's a son that gave up his own life for his parent, which is the last thing a parent would or should want to see. And so Ben realizes, oh, wow, this is a situation which is very much like that wormhole inversion. This could actually be history repeating itself, and Jake could actually relive that timeline if I don't say something to him now. You know, and steer him away from that path. And how am I going to do that? Well, okay, I'm going to do that for Jake by telling him about my life. And in telling him about my life, I get to tell him about the things he needs to know as a young man about life.
Yeah. It hadn't occurred to me until reading this that, like, how those situations parallel each other so much. Like, you have Sisko gone, but not really gone. And that could, like you say, lead to a repeat of Jake trying to undertake what he did in that timeline and stuff. And that was really cool. That was a nice little connection there that to one of my all-time favorite episodes too.
Yeah.
So
yeah, there are a lot of parallels that I try to bring out and show to the reader in this book. Because the more I thought about it, I was like, wow, Benjamin Sisko has his life has a lot of parallels. And just the things that I wanted to say in his life and do in his life, I thought there was a lot of opportunity to show parallels, because I know in life there are a lot of parallels. I know in my life there have been events that something may happen in my life. I'm like, oh, that was a happy event. Or, oh, that was a bad event. And you move on. And then 20 years later, an event will happen. You're like, oh, man, that experience I had 20 years ago as a kid informs something. That's life. That's humanity, right? Something that happened way back informs something as, you know, as you get older. And so I was like, if I can.
It's not linear.
It's not linear. And so that speaks to, that was the beauty of what I was trying to do, was to show that life in many ways, and an autobiography in many ways, is not linear, because things inform things out of sync, you know? And so that's what I'm trying to show in Ben's life and him telling Jake in Jake's life. So yeah, you're reading the subtext. Yeah. Thank you.
Excellent. Well, let's go ahead and sound the spoiler alarm here, I guess. And we're going to take a really quick break. And when we come back, we'll get into spoilers with the autobiography of Benjamin Sisko here.
Save big on brunch for mom, all in the Kroger app. Buy one, get one free on flavorful, fresh Tyson chicken during our full line sale. Then mix or match during our 99-cent sale and get Kraft mac and cheese, Campbell's soup, or Bar-S Franks for 99 cents each when you buy five or more, all with your card. Shop these deals at your local Kroger, less than 5 miles away. Or tap the screen now to download the Kroger app to save big today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Prices and product availability subject to change. Restrictions apply. See site for details.
Thank you so much for downloading this episode of Positively Trek. We truly do appreciate each and every one of our listeners, and I'd like to especially thank our Patreon supporters. Thank you to our Constitution Class supporters, Jim Stoffel, Joyce Marin, and Paul D. Kinnear. If you'd like to become a supporter of Positively Trek and join our crew, please go to patreon.com/positivelytrek. You can get early access to episodes, exclusive content, shoutouts, associate producer credits, ad-free episodes, and more. Again, that's patreon.com/positivelytrek. Thank you all, and live long and prosper. So, starting out in this novel, we've got Sisko's early years, his childhood, and before that even, we get kind of the history of his family and New Orleans and that sort of thing. And I thought that was a really interesting take on a city in the 24th century that we really only see little bits of. I think, like, we see Sisko's restaurant, the inside and the front, and like a cart go by with horses. Right. I thought this was like a great kind of extrapolation of that. How did that idea come about, that not Luddites necessarily, but like just the kind of rejection of a lot of the modern technology of the 24th century?
A few things. And you're absolutely right, Dan. A few things. One, as a fan, just like you and everybody else, we always saw the facade Sisko's, and we never saw what was on either side, you know? And I'm like, I want to know. Don't you want to know? I want to know.
Yeah.
So I know you guys want to know. So let's find out. Let's find out. So that was on my list, right? It was just things that were on my list. And then I thought a lot about Gene Roddenberry. And I was like, you know, Gene Roddenberry says that we have this utopian future. But what Gene Roddenberry, he put a lot of time and effort and thought into creating Star Trek. And what he really says is, well, before we got to that utopian society, World War III happens. It all, the you know what hits the fan. Humanity really messes up, and then we mess up so badly, and we have to look at ourselves so starkly in the mirror, and we're like, oh wow, we need to turn this corner as a species. And as we do that, Zefram creates, you know, warp drive, and then the Vulcans show up, and then we all start to look towards space. So I was like, okay, well, if that's the case, if Gene Roddenberry, Mr. Roddenberry set all that up, then, you know, just think about the DS9 writers put Ben in the best place to put him. Oh my God, Louisiana, New Orleans. And I didn't know anything about really New Orleans. I'd never been. So I spent like 2 weeks just before writing a word researching documentaries. I watched the entire series Tremé on HBO, which is a dope show. And what I've already knew, but really came to absorb and understand is that New Orleans and Louisiana, especially New Orleans, is a service city. You know, it's really about the music, jazz, and food and entertainment, and it's a service city. And I didn't really see that just turning on a dime and saying, okay, we've been a service industry for all these centuries, and now there are replicators and holodecks, and we're going to abandon all that for the future. That's not what humans do. That's not realistic. You know, humans wouldn't do that. They want to hold on to their culture. They want to hold on to their history. And it's also an excellent way for me to make a commentary about Earth, about culture, about Black culture. You know, it was just so many opportunities if I took that route. And I was like, well, it's a little bit more difficult, but it would be so fruitful if I did that. And I think more organic and believable. And so and even in the book, I equate the people of Louisiana to the Amish in many ways, where it's like, you know, we understand we're in the 23rd, 24th century, but we're rejecting that technology. You know, we're holding on to our culture. And Earth says, okay, you know, we're not going to go to war or separate you or anything. Okay, you know, and in doing that and allowing them to do that, it becomes this beautiful place where people can still go and have those ties and those connections to Earth's past. And I think that's something that we would all need in the 24th century as things become so streamlined and clean. We still need those things. You know, we still need the remembrance centers around the world. And we need those things to remember where we all come from. Because technology is great and the future is great, but if you don't know where it's that old saying, if you don't know where you come from, then you're destined to make the mistakes of the past. So
I love the depiction of just where they kind of chose to be technologically speaking. The part that jumped out at me that I really enjoyed was that, like, oh, they just have these primitive smartphones. That's where they have cell phones. It's like, oh, that's kind of funny. It, just turning on our head, kind of what we think of as primitive and what they would think of as old technology and stuff. That was fun.
Yeah,
Yeah.
absolutely. You know, I just thought it would be really cool to do that and show that, you know, there are people that, I know there are people that don't like smartphones, that they still have their flip phones, right? So I was like, yeah, we could, that makes sense. That makes sense, you know?
Yeah, absolutely. I remember reading this and thinking about how important in this book history is to the Siskos and culture. And it made so much sense too, because when you see in the TV series, Ben Sisko is so into this old time baseball thing that a lot of people don't know about. And he's all into jazz and playing the original instruments and not synthesized stuff. You know, it makes so much sense. And seeing the things around his apartment or his quarters or whatever in his office, you know, his culture there. It makes sense that he grew up in that type of environment. And like you said, the restaurant looks that way, right? They're not replicating stuff. They're not beaming in and out. And it just made so much sense.
You know, it's interesting because a lot of Benjamin Sisko obviously is Mr. Avery Brooks infusing a lot of his own personality and all that. So I mean, we know that, but then my job is like, well, why is Benjamin Sisko like that? You know, why does he have this fascination with baseball? Why does he not like 1950s Las Vegas? You know, I know why Avery Brooks would not like 1950s Las Vegas, but why would someone in the 24th century, who where racism isn't a thing, have a problem with that, right? So that wouldn't make sense, right? So I had to really kind of deconstruct a lot of things, and so I looked. Also, I looked to Joseph because as much as this is Ben's autobiography, in a lot of ways, it's Joseph's as well, and it shows that Joseph has certain aspects of pain and trauma and the Sisko family that they haven't let go of from the era of racism and even slavery. And there's that conversation that he has with Ben. And Ben is like, I understand all these things, but I understand why no Sisko's ever left Earth, but that's why I have to leave Earth, you know? And so I tried to show that, like parents do often, they think they're doing the right thing and the best thing, but that thing can often be stifling to the child, you know? And Joseph wanting to keep everyone on Earth in the 24th century, it's a big galaxy out there, man. And you're preventing your kids and your family from partaking in that is really stifling, you know? But that trauma, he can't really see that. And it takes Ben to kind of show him. And then you start to see the family start to slowly open up, you know, like when they go to Bozeman and stuff like that. And even Joseph starts to slowly open up as well in the book. And trying to show that, you know, people don't always do the right thing. People don't always have, they people have issues in their past. I know people in my family and humans have issues, and we don't always learn. A lot of times we learn from our kids, or we learn from our parents or grandparents. Now, I know it's been my experience, so I was trying to put that into the book.
I loved the depiction of Sisko's family and the dynamics and that sort of thing. Like his father, like you said, kind of thinking, feeling like he's doing the right thing and really resisting the path that Ben wants to take. But as soon as it's clear his convictions about this and why he wants to do this, he just turns and will now do everything he can to make sure he succeeds at that. I just, like, that made me emotional. I loved that. And I was thinking while I was reading that, like the episode Far Beyond the Stars, we see Joseph take a trip to Bajor, to Deep Space Nine, to go see his son, and like how far he would have had to come to make that trip after, you know, no Sisko has left Earth kind
right,
of thing.
Right. Or,
you know, that was amazing. Right. That was really
cool.
Yeah,
I remember like I didn't really watch any Deep Space Nine when I wrote the book. I watched Pale Moonlight like four times back to back. And I watched Far Beyond the Stars once. And then I didn't watch any Deep Space Nine after that. And I just wrote. But you're right. In the beginning, I was like, oh, right. I have almost forgotten that. Because, you know, Far Beyond the Stars is such a powerful episode. You forget about the framing.
The framing,
right, you know,
yeah.
For that. I was like, well, right. You know, Joseph is like, that's like the furthest Joseph's ever been. You know, he's like, Deep Space Nine, and I'm leaving Earth to see my son. And I was like, yeah, Joseph really has this thing, you know? And when we see him in that two-parter, Paradise and Homefront, you know, here's a man doesn't like replicators, he doesn't like all this stuff. And that really helped me to frame the Sisko family. It even helped us frame New Orleans a lot. I was like, yeah, that makes a lot of sense. He's a cook, and he's like, he doesn't want to let go of any of that stuff.
Well, you do such a great job of giving life to a lot of aspects of Sisko's family. So like first of all, the family dynamic, but also like the cooking and the feeling around the kind of inn that they run, and the jazz music and all of that is just so strong in this book. And it's been a long time since I've had this experience, but when Sisko goes to high school for the first time and like opens up his lunch in that room, I swear I could smell that. Like, that was great.
That was a fun scene to write. I wrote that. A lot of the scenes I really enjoyed, for some reason, were written like 2-3 in the morning, man. I just, because I don't know why, but it just happened like that. And so that scene was like a late night scene. And I was like, well, you know, what am I going to do? And I'm like, you know what? And it just, I just started thinking about it. And again, you know, once you start things a certain way, it almost starts to fall in place for you. Because I was like, well, it's not going to be, because we've all been to high school, but it's not going to be like our high school. There's not going to be a cafeteria with the food trays. You know, it's going to be slots in the wall, right? And it's going to be a line.
Yeah.
It's going to be a line for the slot in the wall, right? And so,
yeah, who packs the lunch? Nobody's going to pack a lunch.
Who has a bag? Who would be like, what? What are you doing?
Who has a Star Trek lunchbox?
Who has a Star Trek lunchbox, right? What are you doing? Discovery. That's not even a ship. Who knows that? Right? So, you know, but, and so, you know, he gets there and he realizes that, you know, his parents always try to do the best for him, but he's been homeschooled, all of these things. And it helped him foundationally, but he's really the odd man out now. you know? And people are looking at him like, oh, you are just the other man. Because, you know, and crab cakes that, you know. And first of all, we know that that fish of any kind, if it's prepared well or even or poorly, will smell. But if it's prepared well, it just smells so great. And people looking at it, you know, and I was like, yeah, this is good because people like, you know, they don't, what's that? You know, so yeah, that was fun to, that was fun to do.
But yeah, and so eventually, as we've said, he kind of starts to embrace the idea of the new, right? He's playing with the transporter out back and getting into lots of trouble without his parents knowing and undergoing that kind of traumatic experience and stuff. And it's these building of these model starships, which is something I can really relate to, that I love that, that gets him interested in Starfleet and stuff. So it must have been a bit of a challenge to kind of figure out how to transition him from that world into being a Starfleet officer, right? Because it feels like it's a that's a big step for Sisko and his family. And I wonder if was there any particular challenge you found in kind of crafting how that went about?
I did spend a lot of time in his childhood just because I felt it was necessary and it was so foundational. And really quick, that starship where his mom brings him starships, I have an artificial hip and I was in a cast for 6 months where I couldn't move.
Oh, wow.
So that comes from my experience. And my mom brought me starships so that I didn't
Oh,
go,
wow.
yeah, so I didn't go out of my brain and I just would build models. You know, in my bed, build models. So I gave that to Ben, and not out of a conceit, but I
That's
really
cool.
thought it would help the character in that moment, you know. But I don't know. I mean, once I got him out of that and got him to high school, that worked really well because then I realized, and also what really helped was reading the other autobiographies, because that's another thing I did before I started to write. I had already listened to Janeway's by listening to it by Kate Mulgrew was just phenomenal. Una McCormick's work is phenomenal. But I didn't want to repeat anything done in any way in any of the other ones. And so one of the things I really liked in the Janeway one is that, well, it's a little spoiler, in the Janeway one is that Janeway goes to Starfleet early. And so I thought this is an opportunity for Ben's parents to say, you know, yeah, you know, you're smart enough to go early, but man, you don't know what you don't know. And it's a big world. It's a big, you know, quadrant. You need to go to high school first. You need to, and once I had gotten that, and once they convinced him that, then that was great. And then there was that scene I really enjoyed writing when he and the family go to our Starfleet Academy, like the entry place where they're at, where they or the family say goodbye, you know. And that was great. Once I had that scene, it was I knew where I wanted to go for that, and that was a lot of fun doing that. And once I had that, that was like the midpoint, I think, for me in writing the book, because I was saying goodbye to all of his early years, and I kind of thought of the book in like this three acts, you know, his childhood would inform his Starfleet year, Starfleet Academy years, and then his childhood and Starfleet Academy years would inform his years as a man. So, you know, first act, second act, third act.
I really liked that, by the way, with the choice of his parents to kind of say, you know, don't go early. I feel like I most connected with Sisko at that part of the story because like the all of the urges within him would be to say, like, as we all do to our parents at some point in our life, you don't know what you're talking about. You're not making the right decisions for me. I know what I want. And I love that he ended up listening to them and doing that. I just that felt so real having lived in like I'm not a parent, but as an adult now, seeing that side of it more, I really appreciated how both sides there. It just felt so real, you know?
Thank you. I'm not a parent either, but I mean, I've had these experiences. You know, my mom has told me stuff Oh, I don't think you should do that. Oh, you should. I'm like, what are you talking about? And I'm like, oh, she was right. You know? And so, that hindsight, has really informed me as a writer. And giving that in the story, I think a lot of people could identify, with that. And it proved good for Ben. He's this fully formed, when we see him in Emissary, unlike the other captains, he's just like this fully formed person. He's got this balance, and that was a challenge because honestly, it's easier to write someone that has issues or problems because then you can say, oh, where did the problem come from? But here's this fully formed person that's pretty much good to go. He's got a good work-life balance and he treats his people well and all of a sudden I'm like, well, where did all this come from? I really have to show all of this foundational work that was done from his family. And I really got to show all that so that when you can watch Deep Space Nine, like Bruce is saying, you'd be like, oh yeah, I can see that from the book. I can see those lines. I can, so yeah.
Yeah, I kind of wanted to mention that as well because I feel like Sisko is just so unique among the Star Trek captains. Like Kirk, Picard, and Janeway, I think, are pretty much blank slates when they start out. Like when we find out anything about their past, it's because writer X of episode Y decides, like, oh, let's put this in their backstory. Sisko has so much backstory. From the beginning, we see these flashbacks. We find out that he has this trauma, this experience he's gone through that just places him very uniquely. And I felt like, in some ways, that would be kind of a boon to writing him because you've kind of got that to work with, but also maybe a bit of a challenge because you have to construct the rest. You don't have as much freedom, maybe, to kind of construct how that all goes about. So, I don't know if there's necessarily a question there, just like I love how unique Sisko is in that respect. I think that's really cool.
Yeah, and I just want to say to that, I just want to say that, I hadn't thought about it till you were saying that, Dan, out of all the captains or the leads in the Star Trek series, Ben's more of the family captain more than anyone else. And this book shows how strong and how important family is. And so it makes a lot of sense that he's a little more unique than those others because of what is framed in this book about family and tradition and culture.
Both of you are exactly, I mean, I can leave. Both of you are exactly right. I mean, this is exactly it. And it was both a boon and a challenge because we meet him and he's a father. He is a widower in the premiere, right? And so it's like, wow, he, all these things. And then second season is mentioned he has two brothers. Seventh season is mentioned he has a sister, Judith. I'm like, how am I gonna do that? Where am I gonna, why haven't we seen them? Why doesn't he talk about them? So all of that had to come into play. And I didn't want to use something contrived, like, well, his siblings are dead or something like that. I wanted to really lean on things that felt organic and real. So I wanted to create siblings that weren't caricatures but characters and give them full lives. And in doing so, if I gave them full enough lives, then you would understand in the book and the reading why they're not around and why they don't speak about them, because siblings don't always do that, and they're so busy they're doing their thing because of the kind of lives they have. They're doing their own thing, and doing all that, hopefully, it shows you how he became the person that we see from that first episode, Emissary. So yeah, you're right.
So yeah, moving on into, I guess, his academy and early Starfleet career here, we get a lot of encounters with some familiar faces, and I loved the inclusion of characters like Trila Scott from Conspiracy, and a very young Geordi LaForge helping them in the academy situation there. Was there anybody that you didn't get to include that you wanted to throw in there, or anything that road's not taken for
Oh
that?
man, yeah, that was a lot of fun to do that. I've always wanted to write a Trila Scott story, so I was like, I love that character, but they created that character and then they killed her. Well, kind of not really killed her, but what happened to her just left out there, And so I wanted to kind of like answer that question and utilize that character in a way that I thought would be really cool, and continue her character and also make it a pivotal moment in Ben's life. Because by the time he gets to the academy, Ben is still not fully formed Benjamin Sisko that we know. He's picking up things from people, and even Trala says, to him, everybody could see where you should be going or who you should, but except you. He's like, what? And I thought that was a really interesting approach, because I know in my own lifetimes, people have told me, oh, you should be doing this or you should be doing that. And I'm like, what? And because I think that's often who we are, is that we don't always, it's always easier for someone to see something about someone else outside than to look within and see what's happening with us within. And so I wanted to show that with Ben. So he can't see that he's this natural leader. Everybody else around him can see it. He just can't see it until it's really thrust upon him, And as for other people, other scenes, there was that protocol scene. That was a really fun scene to write. And I realized that there's an overlap a year when Geordi, Janeway, and Riker and Ben were all at the academy at the same time. And so I was gonna put them all in that scene. And powers of B were like, that's too much. It was like, that's a little too much. Roll it back. Because it's just too many people in that one room from everyone that we know. And I was like, yeah, that makes sense. I was just really going a little too far. And so we decided on Geordi, because Geordi is needed for that scene. And it's a great meet, it's a great meet to have Geordi. So that, and I thought it was a funny scene though, the crisis protocol scene.
Yeah, that was a lot of fun. Very, very atmospheric with the complete blackness just lit by the transporters going off. It was really cool to kind of construct that in your head while you're
Right,
reading
right,
it.
right. You get
It's
these
fun.
flashes of light, and then it's dark again, and kids crying because they're teens, and they're like, what's going on and what's happening? And yeah, that was a lot of fun. That was a lot of fun.
Awesome. Another bit that I love from kind of Sisko's early Starfleet stuff is his assignment to that starbase where he has to build with this team this wooden sailing ship out of this alien basically sequoia wood, and of course ends up that was a wonderful little reveal at the end, naming it the Defiant.
Yes,
That
I
was
love
great.
that. Yeah, that's another line in an episode of Deep Space Nine. He says, during the academy, some of the times I spent on Starbase 137 was the most rewarding time of my life. I'm like, oh, well, gee, thanks. What do I do for that? And I was like, okay. So I said, this is an opportunity,
That's cool.
right? I was like, this is an opportunity to do a Starbase and to do a whole planet. And I was like, well, what am I going to do? And one of the things that has always been curious to me, and I've loved, is in Next Gen, that whole wood frame for the sensor palette, And I was like, that's really cool, but that can't just be regular wood in the 24th century in a starship. It wouldn't just be regular wood, right? It would be like wood from some planet or something, right? And so I was like, well, this is my opportunity, right, to do that. And like, it's like Sequoia, underwater forest of Sequoia. I mean, that's something totally we've never seen before. And so, yeah, and him on that planet, and having to build an Egyptian barge only with the materials from that planet shows leadership, shows team building, And in the episode Explorers, Sisko builds a lightship, a Bajoran lightship. And what's interesting in that episode is that, he just starts building it and he has these skills. And then he says to Jake twice in that episode, oh, we'll make a sailor of you yet, which is implying that he is already a sailor and he's going to make a sailor out of his son. So I'm like, well, where did he learn those skills? So that's how Starbase 137 came about. I was like, okay, this would be a great opportunity to do all that and put all of that on Starbase 137. And the Defiant
Wow.
was nice, that was a nice
Yeah, it totally makes sense now that you point out that episode. Wow, yeah, that was cool. That's a good callback right there.
Well, we've got of course we've got Sisko's friendship with Dax and all the stuff that he gets up to. I thought that was handled pretty well because Curzon Dax is a character, and I feel like a lot of the women in Sisko's life would be looking at him kind of sideways. So I thought that was handled well, how, you know, Jennifer feels about Curzon and all that kind of stuff.
Yeah. I don't know if I want you around him, you know. I know my girlfriend has told me, like, I don't know if I want you around some of your friends, you know. They were like, yeah, okay, you know. But I mean, you know, that's life. I really enjoyed that relationship, writing that relationship. It was just really a lot of fun, like their first real meet, and just to see how Curzon is just trying to walk all over him, man. You know, because that's what Curzon would do, and has we've seen that he has done with people. And just to see the beginning of their relationship, because Curzon is the kind of person, he's not gonna love you until he respects you. And he's gonna walk all over you until he respects you. So, you know, I have to show where that how that all starts, and that was a lot of fun.
It gives a little bit more insight into Sisko assigning Dr. Bashir to look after the ambassadors in that season one DS9 episode as well.
Right. And where the idea of the framing of them saying of them calling him an old man all the time. You know, I'm an old man. Mm-hmm. You're a lot of things, but you're not an old man. You know, I thought that was really cool. So that was a lot of fun to do that with them.
So from there, we get the Saratoga. Mm. And this was a surprising part of the book here. The Vulcan captain, Captain Storl, who, of course, was played by J.G. Hertzler in the pilot episode. Not a typical Vulcan captain. I thought that was a really fun character in the kind of bridge band that they got yeah. going on there. That was so much fun.
Yeah, man, the bridge crew band. I mean, you know, from my other Star Trek stuff, I try and do things that are different. And show Star Trek and show the world in different ways. But it still all has to make sense. It all still has to fall in with canon and fall in with something that makes sense with Star Trek. And a Vulcan that will play jazz and play the trumpet specifically, it makes perfect sense to me, because he can't emote in ways. Vulcans never emote in ways you expect them to. That's something that we've always known, right? They always find different ways. Because these people are masters at repression. So they find ways, other ways to emote. And for him to emote through one of the most emotional instruments in human history, to me, makes perfect sense. You know, because mm-hmm. he's not going to say things, but he'll show you what he's feeling, you know, when he's holding a note, you know? And then them playing together, if they can play well together and have that kind of spontaneity, then they should work well together. So the logic is also there, you know, his thinking makes sense logically too. So,
yeah, I was not expecting them to break out into a band. And all that. I was like, what is going on? And I thought, I was like, there's going to be some catch. They're on a holodeck or something's going on, but that was really good.
We'll get kind of through the rest of the story a little bit here. We've got, you know, his time on Deep Space Nine, his time designing the Defiant, and how that became such a mission of his because of what he went through at Wolf 359. With regards to the DS9 stuff, was there anything that, like, how did you decide what to include and what to exclude? Because, like, there's so much there, right?
Oh, that, man, yeah.
That it's important to Sisko. Oh, man.
Yeah, that's a great question. I think what I did, I remember I had that same thought. I was like, what to include, what to exclude? And throughout the whole book, I know it's called The Autobiography of Benjamin Sisko, but for me, it's just a father talking to his son.
Yeah, mm-hmm. And Jake's been there for a lot of DS9.
Right. Yeah. So there were things that he's just not going to talk about, because that's not the point of him talking to Jake. Oh, remember that time when we were, that's not, you know, he's trying to give Jake these life lessons. Right? He just got to the wormhole. From Ben's point of view, he just got to the wormhole. He hasn't spoken to his son in a couple of days from his point of view, right? So he's trying to give his son these life lessons and steer his son on a certain path, right? So he's not going to talk about, you know, the time we were all, no. He's, you know, so what Ben is trying to do is talk to Jake about, when it comes to Deep Space Nine and the war and the people and stuff, he wants Jake to know about the people, how he feels about these people. Because Jake will have his own impression of the senior staff, but now Ben is saying, hey, this is how I feel about these people. This is who they are to me. This is no holds barred. I'm telling you who they are. If you ever encounter these people, or if you ever need these people, I mean, of course you don't encounter them, but if you ever need them, this is who I see them as in their truest form. You know, he goes through the list. He talks about Garrick. You know, he gives him his honest opinion on how he feels, who Garrick is, who Bashir is, who all these people are, because he's giving this information to his son because his son might need this one day. And that's what a father would need to give to his son. And that is how I decided what to put in about DS9. It's always for me, what is Ben telling to Jake? Not so much as an autobiography. And I know that people may be like, oh, well, I want to know about this and I want to know about that. And I get that. But from my point of view, is what does Ben want to tell Jake? And then how can I do that? And then show some Deep Space Nine stuff so that we get what we all want. Does that make sense? Yeah?
Yeah.
Absolutely. Yeah. Yeah. And I did love that kind of going character by character and picking out the lessons that Sisko learned about them or about the world through them kind of thing. I thought that was really cool. Also, I appreciated that Jake isn't going to start the next war between, you know, the Federation and the Romulans. He's going to
He's going to leave a little, you know, and I wrote out what he says to him. I did. He's not just black. I wrote it out. And then I, you know,
redacted it there. Yeah.
Redacted it. Thank you.
Yeah. Which is great. Cause when we're getting to that point, I was like, I don't know how you're going to do this. Is he going to reveal everything? He can't. I'm like, how's he going to handle this? And I really love how we got to that chapter at the end. It's like, oh yeah, it's all redacted.
Yeah.
I'm
it's
like,
all redacted.
Yes.
Yeah.
Makes sense. Yeah. Yes.
Yeah. And he's still saying to Jake certain things that, you know, so the reader knows what Ben is talking about. You know, he says like, when you have to, there's an old saying, when you have to dance with the devil, you know, in the pale moonlight, you know, leave before the music, you know, and I was like, yeah, that's, you know, so yeah, so I'm, you know, that's a nod to that, obviously. But that was a lot of fun to figure out, like, how am I going to do that? That was another challenge. There was a lot of challenges in this book because I was like, oh, what am I going to do about that? And how am I going to do that? But that was a lot of fun. That was a fun section. I have a quick question, excuse me, for you guys. What did you guys think about those non-linear sections?
I wanted to ask about that. Yeah, because that was interesting. And again, really informing, it's not linear. Like, it's like the prophets are almost intruding on Sisko's memories of his past events. And he's remembering things different because of what's going on there. I thought that was really fascinating. And I found myself wondering, like, how that looks to Jake as he's getting this information and stuff. And I don't know. I was really fascinated by that. I thought that was cool.
Yeah. I mean, when I first got to it the first time, I was like, what's going on here? Like, I feel like I know what's going on, but it's an autobiography, but it's not really bent. And then I thought, or is this you, like the author, like stepping out of this fictional autobiography and giving this, and I'm like, no, that's not. And I'm like, is it the prophets? Is it Benny? Is it like, you know, I was just like really trying to figure it out. And I had to go back and read the first one again and stuff. But yeah, that was, but yeah, I want to hear what you have to say. Like, what were you doing there?
Well, I was just trying to, I was like, what's it like to be in the wormhole?
Yeah.
Because on top of everything, I think part of my job is to give the reader some kind of sense. What's it like to be in a place like that? Right. You know, and then I remember I was writing, and I knew that I knew I needed moments that just deviate. No warning, no, just deviate, because it's non-linear, you know? And I had gotten to the high school section, and I said, you know, this was a great place, because I realized that by the high school section, I thought that I had the reader so well that when you turn the page, you're not expecting something like that, you know? Mm-hmm. And he's like, what? And people have told me that they're like, is something missing? Is what's happening, you know? And then it's not written in first, it's in third. You know, so it's a whole different, and I think that really, and then if you read those three moments separately, they tell a story. You know? So it's not just it is nonlinear, but they tell a story as well. So there's a lot going on in that. And I'm trying to show what it's like for him, you know, and how the first one is very unexpected and brass, and then the second one is a little bit easier, and then by the third one, it's almost like he's aware of it happening, you know. So things are happening as we're progressing, you know. So
well, that kind of brings me to just kind of the structure and the format of the book as a whole, because when it was first released, I noticed this thing online, and I had already started reading it. I kind of knew what was going on in the book a little bit, but there's this knee-jerk reaction by people commenting on social media, which is just like a whole thing in and of itself. But, you know, everybody, you know, thinks they're so smart because they say it's an autobiography of Benjamin Sisko by Jake Sisko. Well, that's not an autobiography. That's ridiculous. But like, you know, I'm futilely in the comments trying to explain like, no, it's Benjamin Sisko's words. Trust me, you know, just read it, blah, blah, blah. But then I get to the end of the book and there's like, another layer deep. And I love this because it's an autobiography as told by Benjamin Sisko to Jake Sisko, written by Derek Tyler Adico, but also maybe written by Benny Russell as well. And that was such a cool little reveal at the end. I'm kind of curious what the editor and the publisher thought of that and what that discussion was like.
Well, thank you. And I read that same thread, I think it was on Facebook, and I wanted to chime in so bad. I'm like, no, I'll just let them go at it. I'll just let them go at it because, you know. Well, I took like, before writing anything, you have to give an outline to CBS and to Titan, of course. So I took like a week or two, once I had gotten the project, it took like a week or two to write the outline, or maybe more, to write the outline. I took a lot of time just thinking, standing in the shower and just thinking. And I realized that I needed those nonlinear places. I realized that, you know, because all of that had to reflect, you know, this is so much to reflect Deep Space Nine. There's just so many things, you know, it has to reflect the show, and how the show has this realism to it. It has to also reflect this whole nonlinear aspect to Ben. It has to reflect this captain and you know, just so many things, all the things we've been talking about that this autobiography had to reflect. And so I took a lot of time thinking about the outline and packing it all in. And when I gave it to Titan and CBS looked it over, they were like, oh yeah, this is good. And there wasn't really any notes or anything. Everybody liked the ideas I had, which was very rewarding to me because this is also my first novel. So I was like, oh, that's great. You know, at least everybody's liking what I'm got planned. Now I just got to do it. But I was like, okay, you know, I'm not crazy. This is a good idea to for these things. So yeah, that was very rewarding. And then to go ahead and do it was I think the hardest part, right?
Yeah. Well, I feel like it's really fitting because, and I was just thinking this while we were talking here, you know, Deep Space Nine is a Star Trek show, but it's also something more. Sisko's a Starfleet captain, but he's also something more. And that works because this autobiography is an autobiography of Sisko, but it's also something a little bit
more
once you get to the end there. And it just, it fits with what Deep Space Nine means to me as a fan. So
yeah,
I think this works so well as a companion to DS9 and everything it stands for, really.
Yeah. Thank you. And I'm sorry to answer your question about the whole end of it with Benny. I realized in the outline, there's really no way for Ben to talk about the events in Far Beyond the Stars. Mm.
Mm-hmm.
Right? Because he's talking to Jake, and does that not really, it doesn't really make any sense for him to be talking about Jake in the way I framed it. But if at the end, this is Benny Russell, 20, 30 years later, man, and he finally got his stuff published, that's a commentary too, you know? And that's saying something. And that's saying something about this man's life. And then that's very meta. And then you could think about the Strange New World story I wrote, Dreamer in a Dream, and how that all intersects. And so then we did talk a little bit about that. George, the editor, and I was like, oh wow, yeah, that kind of intersects with that other story I wrote, and that's kind of trippy. And yeah, that's a great ending. That's a great way to bookend everything, you know? So
I think it's
No.
an excellent ending. It's perfect for this because it really, to me, summarizes what we've learned from DS9 and the Benny Russell character. There's almost like a blur between the two, so it totally makes sense.
Well, last thing I kind of wanted to talk a little bit about is, of course, the insert photos in the middle, which is such a fun addition. And I can't remember the name of the person you collaborated with to create those, but talk a little bit about how those came about and.
Man, that's just a great story. Russell Walks is the artist. And so Russell was like the first beta reader for the manuscript. Because he had to read it to, you know, do all the images, right? And I didn't know Russell from I didn't never knew him, never met him before. And then one day on Twitter, he posts, "Oh, I just finished reading Attico's manuscript for the autobiography of Benjamin Sisko, and it's great. Wait till you guys read it," right? So then we connected, and we just really hit it off. And you know, he's very, very nice guy, very gracious. And so we started to collaborate, and he was like, "Hey, you know, if you have any suggestions, this and that." And so the collaboration was like, you know, 80% Russell, 20% Eric, you know. But I would say things to him like in the family photo. David and Elias are twins, you know, but Elias is into sports. So can you make Elias look a little bit bigger? Because, you know, if he was, and he was like, oh, I like that, I like that. I was like, yeah, you know, because if Elias is into sports, he's gonna look a little bit bigger than his twin brother. He was like, yeah, it's cool. And it's things like that, you know, hairstyles we talked about and how to do hair and he did that great picture of Ben at like age 7 or 8 with his stuffed animal, Mr. Bayou. And that was a really great picture. And the one that he and I worked a lot on was that Strange Tales picture. And that's a scene out of the Star Trek 2016 Strange New World story, the Dreamer in the Dream, when the Enterprise is going to Deep Space Nine and the Alpha Quadrant basically a flame, you know? So that's that scene. And so we just was like, oh, this would be very meta, and this would be like all these Easter eggs. And so yeah, so we came up with that, and he did a beautiful picture for that. So working with him
Yeah,
was
I'm
was
looking
a
at it
dream.
now. It looks great. Yeah,
Yeah.
I'm going back and looking at these again.
Yeah, he's phenomenal. He's just phenomenal. And I wanted him to do a scene like with the whole crew in their Niners baseball outfits. And he was like, that's good. He said, but it's better if we do Vic's, because if we do them all in Niners outfits, it's basically the same outfit for everybody. And he's like, that's not gonna look good, Derek. If we do Vic's, then we could do different personalities from different people wearing different. I'm like, oh, you're right. I mean, you're the artist, of course you're right. And you know, I defer to you, man. You're the artist. So it was that kind of collaboration, you know, and that kind of synergy between us, that it was just wonderful to have. And I think it's all in the book. And he really breathed a life into these characters, because you can look at these people and they feel like people. At least for me, they feel like people looking at them, you know. Some really great shots in there. So
Yeah, I love the family photo. That's wonderful. It just feels of a time, you know, and
right, yeah.
so good.
So good, so
Yeah,
good.
and I want a Mr. Bayou now.
Yeah.
Right?
I loved we got to see Mr. Bayou. That made me very happy.
Yeah.
And Cisco's daughter takes possession of Mr. Bayou as well. That was really sweet.
Yeah, Sarah Beth Jadzia and Cisco. So, you know, it was just lots of cool things. And, you know, he did really great work. Just phenomenal work he did. I really enjoyed all of the pictures.
Well, I mean, it's no secret. I absolutely loved this book. I think it's incredible. I really hope everyone listening has read theirs already. If you haven't and you listen to this whole thing, as I've said before, I question your life choices. You need to. you've spoiled it. You need to go read this book. But what I want to ask from you now, though, is there anything that you're currently working on that you can talk about that you'd like to share with us?
Not, unfortunately, really anything I can talk about. I can say that I'm using December and January to outline a lot of my own stuff. So I've really never done that before. Just take about, that's one thing that writing this book taught me, the importance and power of outlining. So I'm going to outline like several projects of my own and just get them outlined and done. And then it'll be a lot easier for me to just knock them out. And that's what I'm planning to do for the beginning of 2024. So I'm working on some things that we'll see by mid-24, hopefully.
Somebody needs to talk to Simon and Schuster and get you in their rotation of Star Trek novel writers, I think, because if this hasn't made them sit up and take notice, I don't know. I don't know what they're not making good decisions over there.
Well, you started this before, Dan, so you know.
At least give you a Star Trek Explorers short story. At least that or something. In the
Man,
magazine.
Got some Star Trek stories that would just, people would be like, what? I mean, I've been sitting here thinking all this time. I mean, that's what I do. So I've got some stories. Yeah, I've got some stories. Yeah.
Well, you know, you also need to make a trip to New Orleans sometime and have that experience.
Yes. Have either of you been?
I've been a few times, and I went, the most recent was just maybe a year and a half ago. It was the first place I went to after COVID.
Oh, wow.
Which was kind of a bad idea because a lot of things still weren't open.
Right.
But it's so weird walking around the French Quarter because I keep wanting to go to Cisco's, and I know it doesn't exist.
There needs to be a Cisco's in the French Quarter, right. But there is a Preservation Hall, and yes. I want to go to Preservation Hall because I've never been. You know, and that scene in Preservation Hall, I fell in love with Preservation Hall doing my research. So that's why that became a scene in the book. So yeah, but you're right. I need to go for sure.
Well, where can people find you online if they want to keep up to date with what you've got going on?
Well, you can find me at my soon-to-be revamped website, derekattico.com. And I'm across our social media platforms at DATTICO, D-A-T-T-I-C-O. So you can find me at that moniker or that handle at Twitter, Facebook, Insta, and TikTok currently.
Excellent. Well, thank you so much for coming on the show. This has been a thrill. I look forward to more from you in the Star Trek universe and beyond in the future. Star Trek Adventures. We didn't really talk about that. I have a bunch of stuff that I bought when it first came out, still unwrapped. I've never played. I've never learned how to play. But I know you're active in that and did a lot of work for them.
They're in the book too. It's in the book. I've got there's like 50 to 100 Easter eggs in this book. So stuff from Star Trek Adventures that I've done is actually in.
Oh yeah, the Shackleton Expanse.
The Shackleton Expanse
you mentioned. That's from there. Yeah,
that's from I was like, why not? And CBS had no problem. They were like, yeah, go ahead and do it. So
that's
once they approved it, I was like, they could approve this. They were like, yeah, no problem. Go ahead. So that was that's a lot of fun.
Well, to all our listeners and to Bruce, thank you for coming on the show. Thanks everyone for listening. We will see you in the next episode. And until then, as always, stay positive and keep reading.
Dan, Bruce, thank you. Live long and prosper.
You too.
Thank you.
Thank you, my friend. Yes.
Thank you. Thank you, definitely, Dan. Thank you.
Save big on brunch for mom, all in the Kroger app. Buy one, get one free on flavorful fresh Tyson chicken during our full line sale. Then mix or match during our 99 cent sale and get Kraft mac and cheese, Campbell's soup, or Bar S Franks for 99 cents each when you buy five or more, all with your card. Shop these deals at your local Kroger, less than 5 miles away. Or tap the screen now to download the Kroger app to save big today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Prices and product availability subject to change. Restrictions apply. See site for details.